The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com. Good morning. 12 minutes after 6 on Wheels Up Wednesday. This is the Bill Myers Show, and I am Bill, by the way. You may have forgotten after a couple of days. Took a couple of days off, and it was really enjoyable. Slept until 7 or 8 in the morning, and you know, read news and did other things, but certainly went out to the ham radio swap meet Saturday in Medford, and then got a couple of shortwave radios cheap, some tube shortwave radios, and I spent most of the weekend repairing them on the workbench, and so just kind of getting my mind off of politics because a blown capacitor and resistor doesn't care who's in the White House right now. All right. And so I actually feel quite a bit better here, and I hope you're doing well this morning, too. Join in at 770-5633, 770-KMED. We have Eric Peters, of course, joining us for the Wheels Up Wednesday segment on transportation and more. That'll be coming up after the 6:30 news from our NBC5 news partners. And also State Senator Dennis Linthicum, who's running for Secretary of State. He has a lot more going on, too. We'll talk with him a bit later. And after 8 o'clock, this is going to be interesting, getting a chance to talk about the Russian attack from a few days ago with Colonel retired John Mills. And I believe he seems to have a few doubts about the way it has been painted out there, both in the United States media and also in the Russian media, like you could really just take anything that comes out of any of our world media. Well, unless it's MSNBC. MSNBC, of course, is telling the truth now because the reporters are in charge over at MSNBC, and it's just way, way, way too horrible to have had their viewers listen or watch Rona McDaniel, who I'm not a fan of in the first place, but I'm not a fan of Rona McDaniel, the former chair of the RNC, for a different reason than MSNBC is. But it's great to know that the reporters now control who gets to be hired by NBC News. Yikes. Maybe we'll talk about that here a little bit later. But hey, we certainly have our challenges here in Southwest Oregon. But, you know, sometimes you feel a little bit better just by knowing that it could be a little more problematic just south of the Oregon border. So, hence, we have the California update. In the late great Golden State, it's getting hard to negotiate. Yes, in the late great Golden State, it's, well, you leave your expectations at the gate. It's the late great Golden State. So, we have a couple of stories going on with California that's worthy of note. Captain William E. Simpson, we've talked with him several times over the years. He popped a message out there and also a news report on Siskiyou.news this morning. It's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's a state of emergency. Yep, they had a meeting yesterday at the Siskiyou County Courthouse with the Board of Supervisors. Simpson reports that it was a long and contentious day down at the Siskiyou County Board. Board of Supervisors standing for the best interests of constituents. The online Zoom caller is also lined up to testify both against passing the draft resolution. This, of course, is about the emergency of the Klamath Dam removal, what it's been doing to the people in Northern California. Simpson adds the room was packed with Siskiyou County citizens as well as representatives from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Mark Branson, the CEO of the KRRC, Klamath River Renewal Corporation. I want to change that name, Mark. And numerous county staff, including Rick Dean, Director of Community Development, James Smith of the Ag Commissioner, Elizabeth Nielsen, Deputy County Administrator, Brian Chinon, Director of OES, and Natalie Reed, County Council. A lot of emotional testimony, Simpson says, heard from residents who have suffered insult to injury at the hands of the Klamath River Renewal Corporation's dam removal project. Via KRRC's apparent lack of consideration, collaboration, and transparency. This according to testimony from citizens living on or around the now drained sediment-filled lakes and the Klamath River. Siskiyou County Ag Commissioner James Smith testified. He indicated that the aerial and hand seeding of the remaining sediment banks would probably not stabilize the sediments nor mitigate the dust from those sediments that are considered hazardous to human health. In the end, the vote was 4-1. In favor 4-1 in favor of the state of emergency. And so I guess the whole idea is that then any Tewsom Newsom, Governor Newsom, gets the opportunity to decide what to do about it and will they provide aid. It's not really about restoring the Klamath River. It's about trying to keep some of the damage down in people's lives, apparently. And I guess money will fix the problem that the KRRC ended up causing, in my opinion. Okay. So we'll see there. Now, another story in the late, great Golden State. Wall Street Journal reporting California restaurants cut jobs as fast food wages set to rise. You never could have seen this one coming, right? The California state law set to raise fast food workers' wages in April next month. Actually, this is just a few days from now, to $20 an hour. And some restaurants there already laying off staff, reducing hours for workers as they try to cut costs. California restaurants, particularly pizza joints, outlining plans to cut hundreds of jobs in the month leading up to the April 1 wage mandate, according to state records. Interesting. And finally, in the late, great Golden State, State Farm cuts 72,000 California policies, citing wildfire risk. This starts in July, latest move by the state's biggest insurer to cope with the growing risks from wildfires and other natural disasters. Now, the move comes just 9 months after State Farm announced plans to stop issuing new coverage in the country's most populous state. The latest announcement, the company also cited reinsurance costs and constraints posed by decade-old insurance rules. By the way, there's also a state law which requires these companies to provide coverage. In other words, you're required to provide coverage, and they can't make any money at it because you have to justify all the rate increases, et cetera, et cetera. And so State Farm says, well, like a good neighbor, we're getting the hell out of here. I don't know. Hey, maybe that's how they're going to have to change it. Like a good neighbor, get out of here. Because we're a good neighbor. We're going to tell you to get out of here. So there we go. The late grade, well, you know. In the late grade. Yeah, we have some market headlines, too. We'll share some of those. And, boy, very, very interesting political discussion going on in Grants Pass, that Christine Goodwin lawsuit situation involving the Secretary of State. I'll touch in on that in just a bit.
The Row Gardener, sponsored by Grange Co-op. And if you want to go organic, hey, that's great. However,
see, organic fertilizers are not ready to use by the plant. They have to be worked on by soil bacteria to break them down into a usable form. It has to be in contact with the soil. And better if it's a couple, you know, an inch or two down.
Call the Row Gardener live Saturdays 10 to noon and catch the Sunday morning encore at 9 on 106.3 KMED and 99.3 KCMD.
Freddy's Diner in Old Town Eagle Point has a menu designed to appeal to everyone in the family. Choose from 13 hearty burgers served with fresh-cut fries, crisp and moist pressure-fried chicken, hand-dipped fish and chips, beer-battered prawns, sandwiches, steaks, salads, and more. Dine in or check out the menu online. Call in your order, and it'll be waiting for a quick and easy pickup. Support your local restaurants. Freddy's Diner on Main in Old Town Eagle Point.
Open 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. every day for lunch and dinner.
2x4, 2x8, who do we appreciate? Hughes Lumber, Hughes Lumber. Tweedledee, Tweedledum, the carpenter just hit his thumb. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, what lumberyard has the best repertoire? Hughes Lumber, Hughes Lumber. Mary had a little lamb, but it needed fencing from the ram. She also needed a brand new barn, but only one company has the charm. So when it comes to lumber, what's your choice? Say Hughes Lumber and rejoice on Crater Lake Highway, Hughes Lumber.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With Venture X, earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy and turn everyday purchases into extraordinary trips. Plus, receive premium travel benefits like access to over 1,300 airport lounges where you just check in and chill out. Open up a world of possibilities with Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hi, I'm Paul Stratford with Valley View Nursery, and I'm on 106.7 KMED.
22 after 6, the Bill Myers Show. Believe it or not, Daily Courier actually had a pretty good news article this morning. Actually, it was yesterday that I was reading it. I know. I'm a subscriber to all of them. But you always have to run things through the bias and BS-ometer you know, anywhere you're going, practically anybody you subscribe to in the state of Oregon. It's just kind of the way it goes with media these days. But it has to do with the Christine Goodwin lawsuit. It's actually a lawsuit against the Secretary of State that was filed by Josephine County Commissioner John West, along with Mike Pelfrey and a bunch of other Grants Pass residents, and they're claiming that Goodwin doesn't belong in the second, that she doesn't live in the second district state Senate district. And that she's, in other words, trying to pull a fast one on people. And the thing is that the property that she ends up using is a, well, supposedly it's a house on a winery, even though she has another one. So let me just share a little bit. This is from the Daily Courier story. Goodwin fights back against residency lawsuit. Goodwin and Robinson competing against each other in the Republican primary, by the way, you know that, Noel Robinson. West, a Republican, said the lawsuit was not filed to help the candidacy of Robinson, as Goodwin claims. She keeps claiming this and banging this. Noel Robinson has nothing to do with this one, guys. I can assure you of that. I would take that to the bank. And West said, that's a bald-faced lie. It has nothing to do with that. We feel certain that the documents we have shown and more documents that will come forward that she does not live in the district. Robinson running for the Senate seat held by Art Robinson, who was barred from seeking re-election. Remember the stupid 113 that Oregon voters voted for, supposedly. And I haven't even discussed his campaign with him, West said of Noel Robinson. This has nothing to do with him. This is all about, does she live in her district? We believe not. Goodwin says she lives in Canyonville, part of House District 4. And let's see. She currently holds the House District 4 seat, but is running against Noel Robinson for the seat representing Senate District 2, which includes all of her current House District in addition to Grants Pass and Cave Junction. West Josephine County, I don't know why this has to do with it, but West and Josephine County Community Library District critics Mike and Winnie Pelfrey and other Grants Pass residents filed a lawsuit March 15th alleging that Goodwin actually lives in Myrtle Creek, north of Canyonville, and is outside the boundaries of both House District 4 and Senate District 2. Now, the court date is for April 5th, but she's going to be on the ballot anyway, right? Her name will be on the ballot because of a deadline passed March 20th and a judge didn't issue an injunction. Goodwin said Oregon law allows legislators to have more than one home. She said she has a Canyonville home and has never denied she owns a home in Tri-City, an unincorporated area just outside Myrtle Creek. But you see, the most interesting part of this entire Daily Courier story, they buried the most important part later in the story, burying the lead, I think is how that's termed. In response to a request from the Daily Courier to see her driver's license and other documents showing her home address, Goodwin texted photos of her driver's license and a voter notification card. They both list her home as 721 Bramblewood Lane in Canyonville. West said he hasn't seen any evidence that Goodwin lives in Canyonville. She's never produced DMV records or tax returns showing her residency, or a vehicle registration form, an electric bill, or rental agreement, West said. It'll all come out in court. Now, this is the part that kind of astounded me. Christine Goodwin declined a request from the Daily Courier for a reporter and photographer to visit her at the Canyonville address. Now, remember, this is the winery tasting room that we've talked about for several months here, off and on. We've mentioned this. The winery tasting room, apparently a house. She claims that she's renting a house there. Goodwin declined the request. And she said in a text message, the ranch is not looking for this kind of attention, and I don't feel comfortable stepping on their private property with news stories. Goodwin said she lives in a home on a beautiful Canyonville ranch owned by friends, the winery, right? The Falk family winery, by the way. She said the home has been a quiet place to work, think, and go jogging, and so she wouldn't take a courier, a Daily Courier reporter into the area that she's supposedly renting and where she supposedly lives. She could have made it all go away right then. I don't know. This just smells stinky. I'm so sorry to have to tell you about this. Otherwise, what we've always known is a good Republican, but I guess she's doubling down. The ranch is not looking for this attention. No, it's not about the ranch. It's about whether you live at the ranch. You're supposedly renting a place here, Christine Goodwin, Representative Goodwin. If you actually live there, you shouldn't mind having the Daily Courier come in. You know, have a cup of coffee, sit down, show this place where, how did she put it here? Show this quiet place where you're working, thinking, and going jogging. But having the Daily Courier reporter show up there, is that somehow going to destroy the peace and tranquility of your life? Or might it be because you really don't live there? Generally speaking, when you talk to lawyers and the documentation supports your case, you just throw the documents out there. And that Christine Goodwin will not let a Daily Courier reporter stop by to make sure that she actually lives there. It means that maybe she doesn't really live there, or at least it gives the appearance of impropriety. There we go. We'll talk about that a little bit more this morning too, because something tells me that if she really did live there and had a life set up there, it would be no big deal having the reporter show up. Yeah, let's have a cup of coffee, maybe tea or something like that, or maybe we'll just start drinking heavily as I think about my political future. This is the Bill Meyer Show on KMED and KCMD.
Who'll Stop the Rain is a classic 1970 hit from Creedence Clearwater that reached number 2 on the U.S. Billboard Pop Singles chart. While Millett Construction doesn't know the answer to John Fogerty's question, they do know how to fix your home's foundation if moisture is making it unstable. So don't worry about clouds of mystery pouring confusion on the ground. Millett will fix your foundation, level your house, and solve the water problem that's causing the damage. Get on solid ground. Visit MillettConstruction.com for a free consultation.
The tax laws have changed. Do you understand them? If you need a licensed tax professional to prepare your income tax return, then call Pat Hurley at 774-1040. 774-1040. Wow, what an easy number.
News sponsored by Caveman Heating and Air. It's the climate and we control it. Call Caveman Heating and Air at 541-476-0009 or cavemanheating.com.
Good morning. I'm Natalie Serna with your NBC5 Morning News Update. The city of Phoenix will soon see the construction of a new affordable housing community, which will provide 72 new units. The Pacific Flats housing community is aimed to provide affordable housing to families recovering from the 2020 Almeda fire. The property will consist of 5 three-story buildings and a clubhouse with amenities like a fitness center. It's located just off South Pacific Highway on the 4,000 block north of downtown. Pacific Flats is a collaboration of affordable housing development companies, Commonwealth Development Corporation, and WNC & Associates, Incorporated. Construction will start within the next few weeks. The city manager of Phoenix says that they're looking forward to more affordable housing options for residents. Pacific Flats is projected to be completed by summer of 2025. And as spring arrives, it's important to remember to remove studded tires by March 31st. ODOT says long-term weather forecasts this year do not support an extension of the studded tire season. Studded tires cause about $8.5 million in damage to state highways each year, according to a 2014 study. Driving with studded tires after the deadline can result in a $165 fine. To stay up to date on the latest road conditions, check Trip Check in Oregon or Quick Map in California. That's a look at your morning headlines. For NBC5 News, I'm Natalie Serna, and have a great Wednesday.
Two Dogs Fabricating knows trailers. They sell trailers and repair trailers. So if you'd like your trailer inspected, bring it to the dogs, and they'll sniff it out. Two Dogs will check the axles, hitch, tongue, lights, bed, brakes, and more to make sure your trailer's roadworthy. Most trailers on the road are fine, but it's good to have it checked out once a year. They'll scrutinize crucial welds for corrosion and cracks, too. And if you need any repairs, you'll get a quick, reasonable estimate. Two Dogs Fabricating on Ryan Way, off Sage in Medford.
Siskiyou Pump Service and Rotary Drilling Company takes pride ensuring their customers get fresh, clean water from field to tap. Here's a review from Joe.
I had a water softener in my well pump house and a reverse osmosis system installed. I had absolutely no problems before, during, or after the installation. The on-time technician was professional, knowledgeable, and skilled. I would absolutely recommend Siskiyou Pump Service.
providing fresh water for Rogue Valley residents for over 50 years. Visit SiskiyouPump.com.
Joel here at Butler Ford, and if you're looking for a big truck with a small payment, Ford Super Duties are back in stock with lease deals where you can get a Ford F-250 for only $445 a month. For $445 a month, you can now tow and haul with a brand new big shiny F-250. Nobody knows how to make lease deals work on a Ford truck like Butler Ford. That's why businesses and individuals have been coming to us for years when they want a new truck for a low lease payment, like $445 a month on a new Ford F-250. And lease payments are even lower on F-150 and Ford Escapes. Butler says yes to big discounts and rebates. Butler says yes to giving you more for your trade. Butler says yes to $445 a month on a Ford Super Duty. Butler Ford and Truck Center, just 12 short minutes south of Medford, right off of exit 19, where you know we've got your truck, your SUV, your certified pre-owned hybrid, and EV.
42 monthly lease payments is 7,500 miles per year with 97.48 cash or trade due at signing, excluding tax, license, title, and 250 dealer doc fee on vehicle with a cap cost of $48,125 on approved financing through Ford Credit. Offer expires 3/31/24.
106.3 KMED, 99.3 KCMD, and this is the Bill Meyer Show.
6:34, wheels up Wednesday. Eric Peters, roll on down the highway. Roll on down there. Don't ever drive faster than the speed limit. Ever, ever, ever follow every sign perfectly, which is the way the newer cars are going to be designed. If they're not
That's right.
It already, right? Don't you have an article up there?
A cargo ship, right, Bill?
Yeah. Whatever. Well, the thing is, interesting. I was reading this morning, Eric Peters, journalist, auto journalist at epautos.com. epautos.com, the website, by the way. I found it fascinating. I woke up this morning, and I'm reading that Pete Buttigieg ended up saying that the U.S. taxpayers will pay. We will rebuild the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Now, it's a very sad situation. We still have six dead construction workers, a couple other people pulled out of that after a freighter, the Dolly, ended up striking the pylon and collapsed it the other day, early yesterday morning. And the part I'm trying to figure out, why are the taxpayers paying to rebuild the bridge that a freighter ended up striking and bringing down? Isn't that a strange statement coming out there this morning?
Well, I really love the royal we as used by these people in government. Somehow, you and I and everybody else listening, we get included in we without us even being asked in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, aren't these big carriers required to have insurance?
Last time I checked, they sure were, and lots of it.
And if so, what's the point? So, they carry some kind of indemnity in case of an accident. And then when the accident happens, they don't have to pay, but somehow the American taxpayer has to pay for it.
But I thought that was a very interesting statement. Maybe it was just a typical misfire, a brain misfire of a Biden administration apparatchik. But we'll see. We'll see about that.
Well, it's politics. They want to be seen as doing something, right? Mm-hmm. So they send that brilliant engineer, Pete Buttigieg, out to examine the bridge. And then he promises, we're going to take care of it.
By the way, was that bridge racist? Do we know? Has it been declared racist yet?
I think it was black. Weren't the girders painted black?
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah, it must have been. Well, it was racist to bring it down then, if that's the case, wasn't it? I don't know.
But for me, like, the broader aspect of this is interesting. It's of a piece with the falling apart of everything. Airplanes now fall apart en route in the air. These big ships crash into bridges. Nothing works anymore. It's the third worlding of this country.
Now, it's not Conspiracy Theory Thursday yet, Eric, but I am a little suspicious. I don't know if you read a piece by Laura Logan. You know Laura Logan?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, and she's thinking that that what happened with the freighter is that it was hacked, and that because if the power failure had happened 1 minute sooner or 1 minute later, the freighter would not have struck the bridge. That is what she claimed, which I thought was quite interesting.
I don't know enough to really comment intelligently. I did watch the video, and what struck me as interesting was the ship made an abrupt, almost 90-degree turn directly toward the pylon, which was interesting. If it had just drifted, the power goes out, the thing just kind of drifts in the direction that it had previously been heading, it would have gone under the span, and there probably would have been no damage.
Yeah, so I'm just a little bit, Spidey sense is just a little bit suspicious. I'm not Laura Logan, nor can I talk with her about it, this morning, but I thought that was a pretty interesting wrinkle in the coverage of this. And So I guess we'll just see what happens. What is concerning to me, though, is that this is a major port. This is a major hub of trade going in and out. And if somebody did have bad things to want to do to the United States of America, and I can't think of anybody out there that would want to do anything to the capability of the United States to be able to trade and do things. Can you come up with anything? I can't think of anybody.
It's certainly convenient. And you know, to get back to your earlier point, it's just a measure of the sadness of the times that we live in, where it's probably reasonable to be suspicious on the face of it of everything, because we can't trust anything these people tell us.
Yep.
We can't take it at face value.
And 2020 did so much. 2020, 2021, 2022, follow the science, put on your mask, shut up, take your jab, everything else. And by the way, you're misinformation spreaders. Election denier, too. I forgot about that. I forget about that part about it.
Yeah. This cynicism is pervasive. In a way, it's healthy. You know, I think it's a good thing that people are no longer just baying like sheep and you know, taking whatever they're told as gospel. But on the other hand, societally and culturally, it's a sad thing that we have to be so suspicious of everything.
If you don't mind me gently correcting you, though, you talked about, you know, people not...
I'm not a leftist. I don't mind being corrected.
No, I know that. I understand that. But about a little less than half of Americans are not buying everything. There is still a pretty good majority, or if certainly a plurality of people who are pretty much spoon feeding it. And even if you were to prove to them that what they were doing was a lie and there was no science behind it or whatever it is, they'll still believe it. It's kind of a religious-type fervor. And let's face it, it's also very honest to – it's difficult, honestly difficult to go through your life with that total lack of trust in everything you're hearing from the organs, the state organs and the institutions, I should say. It's difficult to resist that.
Well, it's difficult at first, but actually it gets easier as you go because, you know, once you start to actually think for yourself – you figure things out, and your life gets better.
Yeah, but then the thought police show up, and they say, you've had a little too much to think, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
In fact, you've shared that meme every now and then. I laugh every time you share it over there on EP with the, you know, the cop with the mustache. Looks like you've had a little too much to think this morning, you know, from the thought police, you know?
Yep.
It's one of my favorites. Eric Peters, epautos.com. Hey, let's talk a little bit this morning about unintended consequences. That's something that you had put out there. What we are looking at here, everything coming down in the transportation world about essentially going to a managed society. That's really what's going on there. And I think it would be remiss, rather, in looking at what's been happening in cars and transportation and vehicle manufacturing as just separate parts of a greater whole. You agree?
Oh, absolutely. It's actually a central aspect of it. Now, what's been happening for the past roughly 50 years, these people thought that they could use the pretext of things like making cars safer, making them cleaner, making them more efficient, to gradually winnow down cars and driving, to essentially make it almost impossible to comply with these regulations, which would de facto mean impossible to, you know, to make the cars. But the manufacturers, the engineers, managed not only to comply but to exceed all of our expectations, and we got cars that were effectively pollution-free in any meaningful sense, that were very safe, that got great gas mileage, and the worst part of all, lasted almost forever as a result of that. It's not an accident that cars now routinely go 20 years and 200, 250,000 miles before they get to the point where they're no longer worth keeping up.
It used to be considered, hey, 100,000 and it was junk, right? That's the way it was.
Right.
We were growing up. That was pretty typical.
It's a real problem in a way for the car industry because, you know, they want you to constantly be buying a car. In the past, as you say, at 10 years and about 100,000 miles, you pretty much needed a new car, though. The old thing was becoming unreliable. It was becoming a money pit. So you went and got a new car. Now you don't have to. It's no longer a question of, well, I can't afford it. It's like, why would I do that? My car's perfectly fine.
But the world improvers,
100,000 miles ago.
Yeah, but the world improvers really hate this idea because the whole agenda was not about keeping you safer or reducing pollution. The whole idea was not having you have a car, and only the elite would have a car, right? Is that pretty much the bottom line?
That's why they brought out this EV juggernaut, because they had to figure out a way to solve this problem of cars lasting too long and being too good. So the first thing that they did was to categorize carbon dioxide, which has nothing to do with air pollution, as an emission, you know, and they did that deliberately. And it is technically an emission in the sense that it's being emitted. It comes out of the tailpipe, but it has nothing to do with pollution. But psychologically, people hear that word and they think about dirty things. They think about fouling the environment. They think about air pollution.
And the kids have been inculcated into this, that carbon dioxide, which they themselves are breathing out as a natural part of respiration, is a pollutant.
Yep, but they present these EVs as, well, these are zero emissions, you know, and they know they have a low carbon footprint.
They're not zero emission, though. They're just an emission somewhere else, though, Eric.
Correct.
Okay.
They managed to market them that way, and they were pretty successful at doing it. But, of course, the thing about the EVs that fixes the problem is that they are inherently short-lived vehicles due to the batteries. You know, this is not going to be a vehicle that you have for 20 years and that even after 20 is going to be something you can hand down to your teenage kid as the first car.
Do we have some actual real numbers that are showing how long the battery packs will last in real everyday, let's say, all right, you know, I only drive maybe about 6,000-7,000 miles a year, but a lot of other people who live farther away from work, it's not unusual to have a 15,000-20,000 mile a year, you know, kind of existence, which I'm sure the world improvers hate people like that, but still, that's what we have. It's no big deal in a regular gasoline or diesel, you know, hybrid or regular conventional vehicle. No problem with that. But if you're doing serious travel on an EV, do we have any stats on how long the battery packs will really last? Have they been out long enough that we know for sure now at this point?
Well, here's what we can use as a gauge. The government, the EPA, with its most recent batch of regulations, put forward that it's acceptable for an EV battery to lose, I think the figure is, up to 30% of its charge capacity over 8 years.
It's acceptable by the feds. To lose one third of its range, all right?
Yeah, and it's inevitable if you subject an EV battery pack to heavy discharging and then recurrent fast charging, high voltage fast charging. That's what will kill the battery quickly. And the paradox is that in order for the EV to be even remotely practical, you have to use the majority of the range that you have. And then if you don't want to sit around and wait for all day, literally, to get the thing going again, you go to one of these fast chargers. But that's what reduces the service life of the electric battery, and that's what makes the vehicle a throwaway because of the cost of replacing the battery.
Now, if my regular car, which, by the way, is 14, how old is it now? 14 years old. If someone had told me when I bought it 14 years ago that 8 years in, instead of going 350 miles on a tank, I would only do 275 or 260, I'd be flipping angry about that. I'm surprised that there hasn't been more pushback on this.
Well, it's the same reason there hasn't been, you know, among the 50% of the population that you mentioned, much outrage about, well, wait a minute, you told us if I took this vaccine, I would be immunized. I wouldn't be getting the Rona, and I wouldn't be spreading it. And now it turns out those were both lies. It's like this, I don't know what you would call it, this internal suppression of objective reality for the sake of what you just said earlier, this religious ideology that will not allow reason and facts to penetrate.
Great article this morning about this conversation. It's Unintended Consequences, and you can read up and get the whole story on epautos.com. But the unintended consequences of the regulatory apparatchiks is that the cars are better than they've ever been, right? You know, it's
no
really
question.
Yeah, and that's just it. And so the only way that they'll essentially be able to get us out of it is to regulate them out of existence, or maybe regulate our ability to even use them as time goes on?
Well, yeah, that's effectively what they're doing with this EV thing. You know, they are winnowing down the number of engined vehicles, purely engined vehicles that you can still get. By the way, you know, that business about, oh, they dialed back some of the most onerous of the regs that we had been talking about, it's a little bit true, but it's actually not that true. Rather than requiring that, say, two-thirds of all vehicles that are sold by 2032 be purely electric, a majority of them will be hybrid, which is partially electric. So it's that same three steps forward, one step back, but nonetheless, you're moving in the same general direction.
Oh, I see. So we'll feel better about it for a little while because they'll say, well, all right, it's not going to be pure electric, but here's a hybrid, right?
Yeah, and that's just for now. You know, if they are reelected, elections do matter. I mean, as awful as it is, you know, I've got an article coming about that very topic. Nonetheless, if they are reelected this fall, then the gloves come off, and then it will really get serious. You know, the only chance we've got to potentially put a stake through the heart of this thing, and again, I'm not so much singing the praises of the orange man as I'm sounding the alarm about the other thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good point there. Eric Peter is automotive journalist at epautos.com. If you have a question or comment on anything we've been talking about, or you want to ask Eric a question about a vehicle maybe you're looking at or having an issue with, let's talk. 770-5633. We shall return shortly on Wheels Up Wednesday on KMED and KCMD.
Stephen Westfall Roofing Incorporated, 601-9108, specializing in new construction and re-roofing. Are you looking for a reliable and experienced roofing company for your roofing projects? Stephen Westfall Roofing is here to ensure you'll live under a long lasting roof, using the best materials in the market based on performance and quality to keep the project within your budget while avoiding additional costs. Call us today for an estimate tomorrow. Stephen Westfall Roofing Incorporated gets it done. 541-601-9108.
CCB number 230804.
A recent Clouser Drilling customer shares her experience.
This is Susan from Griffin Creek. And listen, if you need a new well, I want you to call Clouser Drilling right away. They were absolutely fantastic. Everything from locating the water to the drilling process itself. Their staff was top-notch, thorough, professional, on time, precise, friendly. Answered all my questions, and believe me, I had a lot of them. You won't regret it. Call Clouser Drilling.
Visit ClouserDrilling.com.
We made it to March, so we get to trade in winter rain for spring rain. That's where Terra Firma Foundation Systems comes in. One easy call can protect your home from the damage rain and saturated soils can do to your foundation, basement, or crawl space. Don't sit up all night with a shop vac. Don't convince yourself it'll be fine when it dries out. Have Terra Firma come out for a free waterproofing evaluation. Visit GoTerraFirma.com to schedule your free waterproofing evaluation. That's GoTerraFirma.com. CCB 173-547.
The Bill Meyer Show, 106.3 KMED, 99.3 KCMD.
In the late great Golden State, it's getting hard to negotiate.
From the late great Golden State, we have Tracy, who is over in the Central Valley. And you just moved from Baltimore. You wanted to talk with Eric Peters, EP Autos. How are you doing this morning, Tracy? Welcome back.
Just great. First, the law of unintended consequences about EV, since I'm down here in the valley. There's apparently a big pile of sulfur down near Bakersfield, near the Kern County oil fields. That sulfur is used as a fungicide for all the grape crops. So if the wine-sipping fanatics want to kill off the oil industry, they're going to kill off their grapes because that's what helps the grape crop.
Interesting.
The other unintended consequence is that one of the largest Tesla fast charging sites down here is on a place called the Grapevine as you head over the mountains toward Los Angeles. And there's a gas turbine attached to that charging station.
Of course there is.
Okay. So, right. It's a zero emission vehicle, right, Tracy?
Correct. Okay, so Baltimore.
Yeah, you remember, Bill, guys, probably about a year ago, I wrote a piece about, I can't remember where it was, it might have been in Texas, there's some enormous, it's in California, I take it back, mass EV charging depot place. And as it turns out, across the street, there's a huge generating, I think it's a diesel generating system as a backup for when the load gets too high.
Wow. Tracy, tell us a bit about the fact you just moved from Baltimore, though, so you get this situation with the bridge collapse. Give us your take on that, huh?
So, I've driven over the Key Bridge a few times. It's important because that's the hazmat route. If you've got a truck full of fuel or whatever toxic material and you're not allowed to drive it under the Fort McHenry Tunnel on I-95, you're going to go over the Key Bridge.
Uh-huh.
So it really fouls things up. It's not a high transit route per se, but it's definitely fouls things up. So the Port of Baltimore is the number one port for auto imports in terms of value. A lot of high-value European cars transit through there. Frequently, I would see a lot of the specialized truck-carrying ships come in or passenger car ships come in. And, you know, you roll in, roll off your cars like they'd have on the logo Nissan or whatever. My own car that I drove back here to the East Coast, I got it and I tracked it all the way from Germany and it came into the Port of Baltimore. So it is going to have a dramatic effect on the import auto industry and also the exporting of machinery. Roll on, roll off cargo of such as a large tractor or a construction machine. That is stopped because that's That was your port for that.
All right.
It is going to have a dramatic effect.
Tracy, I really appreciate the insight on that. Interesting interesting call. Appreciate you making it from the Central Valley. Wow. That's something. Someone who lived there actually observed it in action.
That's a really big deal because, you know, people not familiar with the East Coast, I-95 is the major corridor up and down the entire eastern seaboard, all the way from Maine to Florida. And I guess, you know, as the caller says, you know, the stuff that's considered hazmat, in order to continue driving, you know, you have to go over that bridge in order to continue. I don't know what they're going to do, how they're going to route that around, because as he says, you can't use the Fort McHenry Tunnel, which I've driven through many, many times over the years.
Yeah, let me go to line three, which I believe is Bob from Medford. Hello, Bob. You're with Eric Peters.
Hey, good morning, Eric. Good morning, Bill. Over the weekend, I read an article about urine-powered vehicles, ships and cars and planes, i.e. nitrogen. And, you know, back in the late 70s, propane was a big thing, and we also did buses. You know, gasoline is a byproduct of all the fracking of all the different components of oil, so there's a lot of that used, you know, initially burnt off as a byproduct till they learned how to run it in an engine. So how much faith can we put in alternate fuel engines, you know? And, I mean, this is stuff from Mechanics Illustrated back in the 30s and 40s.
Okay, yeah. So, in other words, you know, please whiz in the cup, and then we get a few miles.
Exactly.
Well, I can't,
but, I mean,
I can't.
The whole concept of alternate fuels.
All right. Oh, you know, so in other words, you're questioning the concept of the alternate fuels then. Eric?
Right. In a free market, I love the idea of having, you know, alternatives. In other words, somebody brings forth an alternative. Hey, let's try this and see if it works. And if it works, great. You know, people will look at it and say, hey, that's a great alternative. I think I'll try that. You know, I can remember back in the 90s, I had the opportunity to test drive a number of CNG-powered vehicles, and they operated just wonderfully. You know, these were V8 Crown Victorias for Ford, and the old Caprice, the Shimano oil body that GM was fooling around with propane dual-fuel versions of these things. And they worked really well. I mean, they had some downsides, but from a functional point of view, they worked fine. And I love the idea of a free market in which people are free to bring forth alternatives and let the market decide whether those are better or worse alternatives.
All right, Bob, I really appreciate you calling for that. Thank you. You know, the point being, when we look at the EV, and by the way, this is not about bashing EVs, but EVs are, you know, electricity is not an energy source. You know what I'm getting at? It's not the original energy source. All it is something which was transmitted or generated by some other, whether it is hydroelectric, whether it is wind, whether it is solar, whether it is oil, natural gas, or whatever the case might be. And I think people sometimes don't quite grasp that. And the one thing you can say about internal combustion engines is that, yes, the energy density of a gallon of fuel is real. It is there. It is very dense. And that's why it has been the most convenient way to fuel the system.
Yeah, well, and it's also immediately converted into mechanical energy. You know, as you say, you know, first the electricity has to be produced, and it has to typically be produced at some centralized utility plant. And then it has to be transmitted over the wires, over the transom, as it were. And then it has to be put into the battery, you know, the electricity storage device, which is what the battery is. So you're adding all of these steps along the way that introduce their own inefficiencies and costs along the way.
But I have noticed that when EV fanboys are talking about the efficiency, they'll talk about the efficiency of the electric motor, which is very efficient indeed. Okay,
and that's absolutely true.
You know, it's absolutely true. But and they'll say, well, an internal combustion engine car is only 2%, maybe 1 to 2% efficient through the entire chain from drilling to transporting, refining, and everything else. And maybe that's true, but what they kind of drop the ball is that they don't put the same thing on, all right, what's the amount of energy to make the battery pack? What about the rare earths for the magnets? They kind of step aside and try to throw some sand up in the air, I think, into people's eyes.
You know, you can hit this from a number of different angles. What's efficient about dragging around 1,000 pounds of a battery in order to store the energy equivalent of about 50 pounds worth of gasoline? That's one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, what's efficient about reducing the useful service life of vehicles by 50% or more so that you have to throw it away and then re-get all those resources out of the ground, manufacture them to build yet another EV as opposed to keeping a vehicle that was manufactured 15, 20 years ago and is still providing daily service.
And just keeping it on the road, all right? Eric Peters with me, epautos.com. Hi, who's this? Good morning. You're on. Welcome.
Hey, Morning. This is, hey, it's Talent Tony.
Hey, Talent Tony. Go ahead.
Hi, Eric. As I'm sure you guys know, lead acid batteries are highly recyclable. Lead is relatively cheap compared to lithium. I deal with a lot of 18, 20 volt power tool batteries, and I actually have to pay to dispose of those at my local battery dealer. So can you speak to the recyclability or lack thereof of all these giant, enormous lithium ion batteries that come in these electric cars? What do they do with them? Do they get landfill?
I'm glad you brought this topic up, because something that people are not aware of is that the lithium, which is the key component of a lithium ion battery, it gets used up. And once it's used up, it's gone. You need to extract more of it or refine more of it in order to build yet another battery.
Oh, I didn't realize. So it's not like a lead acid battery in which you have lead sulfate, or the old batteries are filled with lead sulfate, but you can remanufacture it into a new battery, right?
Right. So economically, it's not worth dealing with this 1,000-pound useless brick that was your electric car's battery pack. And as far as I know, there have been no provisions made to deal with this. And you can imagine, as this scales up and you've got millions of these things out there that are being just junked and thrown away, what happens to those things?
Will we end up possibly seeing the kind of scenes that we have right now, in which we have just acres and acres, hundreds if not thousands of acres of landfill with windmill blades on them from the wind power companies?
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that's going to happen. And then you think about the wastage, the gratuitous, senseless waste, which is interesting because, after all, these things are put forward as environmentally responsible. Mm. You've got a 10-year-old EV, the manufacturer no longer supports it. It's useless because the battery is too expensive to be worth replacing. And the rest of the car now is just fodder and junk, and just throw it away.
Yeah. Tony, appreciate the call. Let me grab one more. And hi, who's this? Good morning.
Yeah, Ron Grass Pass.
Yeah, Ron, go ahead. You're with Eric.
There's a whole new industry out there, and it could be condom and or vaginal catheters that are connected up that go directly into the gas tank and or into the carburetor.
Oh, back to the nitrogen-powered ones. Okay.
How about methane-powered cars? You have some kind of fart-collecting mechanism built into the seat.
Ron, thank you for giving me a laugh. We always appreciate that with the EP Auto's Wheels Up Wednesday situation. Hey, before we take off, you got a lot more going on there. We just scratched the surface of it, but what is your review for the week? It's an Audi this time, and how is Audi doing right now with their latest? Huh?
Well, like some of the other high-end manufacturers, they were and might still for the moment be doing okay, because they've got a number of appealing models that people want to buy. But as they continue this rabid lemmings rush over the cliff of the EV transition, they're going to find that they're not going to be doing so well, because, after all, one battery-powered appliance is the same as any other battery-powered appliance. I hate to see it happen to them, because they do make some neat cars. The A5 is an example.
Okay. Now, is the A5 all electric, or is it still internal combustion?
Well, it's what they call a mild hybrid, and all that means is that it's got a 48-volt electric system to power our favorite thing, ass, the auto stop-start system. So it's got a high-torque, belt-driven start system that uses the 48-volt electric to cycle the engine on and off, but it's still basically fundamentally a gas-powered vehicle. It's similar to, you remember the personal luxury coupes that used to be everywhere back in the 70s and the 80s, models like the Pontiac Grand Prix, the Ford Thunderbird, and the Olds Cutlass, remember those?
Yeah, and they're barely made any longer. There's only a few
nobody
of them left, right?
Them any longer.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that nobody has is going for the personal coupe any longer? Is it everything is about the SUV right now, or the crossover, right?
Well, the main reason is, of course, that the federal fuel economy regs, CAFE, killed off the large and mid-sized platforms that those cars were based on, which were all rear-wheel drive and V8. They're gone. So now, you're talking about cars like this A5 that are, luxury badge vehicles that are much more expensive. This thing starts close to $50,000. But still, it's stylish, and it's a way for somebody who doesn't want to drive a pokey-looking four-door sedan to have a more attractive and slick-looking two-door car that still has rear seats and is still, therefore, plausibly practical.
I have to tell you, though, the A5 is a great-looking vehicle.
It
actually looks like someone actually styled it, rather than just merely melting a piece of wax.
and I like the subtle styling of it. It has that nice mix of elegance and prestigious lookingness, if you will. But it's not flashy. It's not trying to make a big deal of itself. And I've always I've always liked that quality.
Also, something I like about it, just looking at the face, and of course, vehicles have a face. The vehicle's face is not unfriendly, and it's not, you know, there has been such a push now in which the vehicles right now these days, so many of them seem to look downright mean, kind of the
angry catfish face.
Yes, yes, angry catfish. That's it. That's it. And this is not. This looks like, in fact, it is understated in many ways, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did a very nice job with it. And from a functional point of view, another thing that they did that emulates the old personal coupes of the past was that the roof line's not really abruptly raked to the back, mm-hmm. so that the rear seat headroom is decent and serviceable. You know, a lot of two-door, four-seat cars, not only is there no legroom, but there's essentially no headroom either, and so they're just vestigial and pointless seats.
All right. And so what was your impression as far as the drive, though, the driving of it?
You know, they do a really good job with not that much, because guess what it's got under the hood?
Four-cylinder?
2.0 liter turbocharged four-cylinder.
Okay, this is starting to sound like a...
But, you know, again...
This is a never-ending joke. Every week it's the joke. The joke's on us, right? Four-cylinder is now the luxury car, right?
But it's kind of like the unintended consequences thing. It just shows how, you know, how brilliant that they are, that they can work with this onerous regime that they're placed under. You know, the V6 has become what the V12 was 20 years ago.
Sure.
That is, it's an exotic and exclusive engine now for the rich only. But they still managed to make these little four-cylinder engines produce as much or more power as the V6s and even some of the V8s used to. Of course, it's a temporary thing, because eventually they're not even going to be able to build the 2.0-liter engines anymore.
Mm-hmm. What has concerned me, though, is how do these heavily turbocharged engines last? Because there's a fellow on YouTube called I Do Cars. I forget his name.
Yes, I know him, yeah.
Yeah, you know him? Okay.
Well, I mean, I know his stuff, yeah.
Yeah, you know his stuff, but... He ends up bringing up vehicles that have blown up engines, and he has horrible things to say about the Chevrolet three-cylinder engine that is powering many of the crossovers right now in America. And I think it's a three-cylinder 1.4, and he says they're just pieces of junk. He says they just blow up left and right, and you know, but they're turbocharged heavily in order to move the vehicles around.
Yeah, well, that's why in the past turbos were considered power adders, and you generally didn't find them except as optional equipment in high-performance cars, where there was a trade-off that people were willing to accept, in that, hey, I'd like to get more power in my Porsche Turbo 911, so mm-hmm. I'm going to, you know, get one with a turbo in it. But they were rarely, if ever, found in just basic A to B cars. Now they're ubiquitous. They're, you know, probably 8 out of 10 vehicles now have a turbocharged engine, and whether their long-haul durability will be what we've become used to remains to be seen.
There's a lot to be said for perhaps the slight inefficiency of a six-cylinder or even a V8 in some vehicles, given the fact that the engine is most likely not very badly stressed.
Oh, I think there's a lot to say. You know, I make a point of referencing the gas mileage figures in my reviews, and when you compare the you know, city highway numbers of these turbo 2.0s versus the V6s that replace them, the difference is nominal. And typically, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 miles per gallon. And that's a who cares, as far as I'm concerned. I don't think most people care that much about the mileage, but it's all about compliance, and that's why this is happening.
Yeah, the compliance vehicle. 2024 Audi A5 Coupe is up there on epautos.com. Mm-hmm. We'll grab one more call before we take off, and let's see if it's someone with a good question. Hopefully you are. Hi, who's this? You're with Eric.
Hi, it's just Washington Larry.
Hey, Washington Larry, fire away. What do you got?
Yeah, late model Honda Ridgeline 22. It's 280 horse. But somebody told me about these performance shifts. Easy to install, more power, better gas mileage. What's your opinion of these? Leave it alone?
Well, you know, you do risk, I don't know how much you care about your warranty coverage. If you have the ECU reprogrammed to deliver better performance, it's possible that the next time you take the vehicle in for service, they will plug it into their diagnostic machinery, and then they will know that you've done that, and that may be cause for voiding the warranty. Now, will it hurt the vehicle? Probably not. But, again, you know, you have to decide whether it's worth it to you to risk your warranty coverage.
How tightly do they investigate your vehicles in Washington State, Larry, when you take them in? Do you know?
I haven't even done it yet, because it's I've only got 8,000 miles to just go back and forth to work, and... So I haven't even gone in. I haven't even gone for my second maintenance yet, because I've only got it.
So am I hearing from you, Eric, then, if you're going to get those tune chips, that you want to be very careful before you go that direction? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, yeah, you want to think about it, because really, when you bring a modern vehicle in for service, even an oil change, they're going to hook it up to their diagnostic computer. The computer is then going to communicate with the vehicle's ECU, that is the computer that controls it. And if it comes up with a code or something that says, hey, the thing has been altered, you're in trouble. They're gonna void your warranty.
Yeah, and maybe you wait until after the warranty's over, Larry, if you're going to do that. What do you think?
Good idea. Thank you so much for your info.
All right. Hey, appreciate that. 770-563-3770-KMED. We have time for one more call if I can get him through here, Eric.
Definitely.
I know sometimes you run a little bit late on Wheels Up Wednesday, but that's half the fun. That's half the fun of it. Let me see if I can get this person on here. Push the button. Push the button. Are they pushing the button? Maybe. I don't think they hung on. All right, they're probably figuring we were done at this point. All right, so we'll just let that go. Eric, always a pleasure talking with you, and we will catch you next Wednesday on Wheels Up Wednesday. And what do you think you're going to have as a review next week? Do you know yet?
Well, I actually know. I actually did look to see, because I figured you were going to ask me that. And it's interesting that the caller asked about the Ridgeline, because I will be having the 24 Ridgeline tomorrow. So I'll have that next week when we talk.
All right, no kidding. Hey, we appreciate that greatly. We'll see you next Wednesday. Thanks, Eric.
Sounds good, Bill. Thank you.
EPautos.com. It's 8 after 7.
This is Bi-Coastal Media's KMED and KMED HD1 Eagle Point, Medford, and KCMD Grants Pass.